Nice to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you along today as we take a look at caregiving for people with Alzheimer's, really through the eyes of Mary Ellen Geist. She is the author of the book Measure of the Heart, A Father's Alzheimer's, A Daughter's Return. It's published by Springboard Press. She was most recently the afternoon anchor at WCBS Radio in New York, and prior to that, she was the morning anchor and reporter at KGO Radio in San Francisco, a reporter in Los Angeles. She now lives on a lake in northern Michigan, and in the winter of 2005, she moved from New York to return home to Michigan to help her mother care for her dad, who was living with Alzheimer's disease. Woody Geist had been a CEO, of an industrial distribution firm in Detroit, E&E Engineering, and suffers from Alzheimer's. And Mary Ellen made a big leap. Mary Ellen Geist, welcome with us by phone. Welcome to the show. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It's great to be with you.
I can relate very well to your book, and I'm enjoying reading it. I just got it yesterday, so I only got halfway through, but it's a wonderful read. And my mother passed on from Alzheimer's, and my sister gave up her good job in San Francisco of many years and moved back to Madison, Cottage Grove, Wisconsin, to care for my mother.
Very similar.
So there were, as I read some of the things that you were writing about, I'm sure that my sister has gone through that, and as family members, we've all gone through those things. I want to give people a chance to join in and just remind you, if you'd like to visit with Mary Ellen, you're most welcome. Maybe you've got some questions for her or some stories of your own to share. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments. Talk about first when you first saw signs of your father's senility.
Well, in the Detroit area, as you know, all our fathers are involved in the car business. My dad was CEO of this company, and he drove all over, and his car was his identity. And not only his car, driving his car, you know, all over the place, his big car. All our fathers drove big cars from place to place. Those were the days. That's when you could afford gas, and you could afford big cars. And he also was wearing a suit to work every morning and tying a tie. And I think one of the first things that happened where we knew something was wrong is he started getting lost driving to familiar places. He'd be really just a few miles away, and he would call my mother. He had one of the first car phones. There weren't cell phones with everybody then either. And he said, I don't know where I am. And he actually went up to the gas station attendant, and he could not tell the person where he lived. So it was a very strange thing. And then we started going out to events. My mother would go out to a musical event with him or see old friends at dinner, and he wouldn't remember doing that the night before. But the biggest thing, I think, was when he spent a long time in the bathroom one evening trying to get ready to go out to dinner, and he emerged from the bathroom holding his tie in his hand, and my mother says he had like a look of terror in his eyes, and he said, I can't remember how to tie my tie. And that was what a lot of my mother's women friends, they said that was one of the first signs when your husband doesn't know how to tie his tie.
So he was still had some faculties about, and he still does for that matter to some extent, but he himself studied up and read about Alzheimer's.
He did. He and my mother were very studious about this, and they started reading books right away about what to do. He actually wrote letters to each of us, his three daughters. I have an older sister, Allison, a younger sister, Libby, and he wrote us this poignant letter saying, you know I have Alzheimer's disease. My mother, you know, I've decided that your mother and I will continue our lives as much as we can and do all the things we'd wanted to do in retirement. We're going to do them really quickly, though. So they started going on cruises, and they went to Europe, and they did all. And even as they went off to do that, it was difficult for my mother because she had to make sure he didn't lose his passport or do this or do that and pack him up, because even at that time, you know, at 1994 is when he was diagnosed. And he already, right away, you know, started forgetting how to do normal daily living things. But he remains, to this day, 14 years later, someone who can still sing, and he has an incredible optimism. And I think this helped my parents to be in, keep my father in this world in a way that someone that had a different kind of character or capacity, it might have been a very different story. They did lots of things at the beginning, and they also went right away to a forward-thinking psychiatrist, Dr. Stephen Aronson in Ann Arbor, Michigan, at the University of Michigan, and they got on experimental drugs and trials right away, discovered Aricept, took that as soon as it was available, and then began a whole cocktail mix of antidepressants and mood drugs, and also some other kinds of drugs for things like getting him so he would sleep well in the night, and anti-anxiety drugs. And I think this has really helped my father to continue having this disease in the way he's had it, in a way that he can function in the world in a normal way, and that we can have him home with us because of they were so progressive at the beginning.
That is the very good news from a kind of a well, not kind of a sad situation for you and your family. How did you? I mean, here you are, an afternoon anchor, a highly paid, high energy job. With you're single, you've got a kind of a great life. How did you decide to come back? Go back home and live with mother and dad.
Well, you know, I want to make this clear to so many people. Actually, there's a couple of my friends that have called me in Rochester, Michigan, which is actually the high school I went to was Rochester. We lived in the country outside of Detroit in Romeo in Washington, Michigan. And a lot of my friends are calling me and saying, my mother's calling me and saying, you have to quit your job and come home and live with us. And they're really mad at me. I'm not advising that all adult children leave their jobs and come home to live with their parents. I could do it because we really get along. And because of, I think you did say, you know, I had a great life, and I did. I had done so many things. I mean, I had an absolutely fabulous time in Los Angeles. In San Francisco, I would go to the wine country on weekends. I'm pretty athletic, and I would go skiing, and I had a great job, and I felt I was able to work for the network as well, and I'd gone overseas on breaking stories. I covered the U.S. occupation of Haiti. I covered the Sydney Olympics in 2000. I covered the hanging chads. I covered the O.J. Simpson trial. I'd covered all these big stories, Princess Diana in London. I felt I had accomplished so much, and I think that is actually one of the reasons I was able to leave. I really had a wonderful time in each city I lived in, and felt that I was at a certain point, I'd done so much of what I wanted to do. And I started weighing my life against my parents' life. And, of course, this is the other very special situation. I did not have a husband. I did not have a mortgage on a home. I didn't have kids. So I was in the unusual circumstance. If I would just change my life completely, come home and live with my parents, other people would not go down with me. No one would suffer. And I also was questioning my life. And I think a lot of people in midlife, I know you can call it a midlife crisis, it didn't really feel like a crisis to me. It felt like a change in values. And I think a lot of friends of mine on the West Coast and the East Coast, they have parents that they've left in the Midwest. It's very much a problem, I think, how we coordinate our relationship with our parents as we get older. And for me, I just was seeing that my life was on a trajectory upwards. My parents' lives were on a trajectory downwards. And I just thought, what the heck? What is the huge risk? And I also was starting not to like myself so much. A lot of my identity was wrapped up in my job. All it was about was me and my job and my identity. I'd introduce myself with the call letters of the radio station after my name everywhere I went. And it was everything, and at the cost of relationships. And for once in my life, I said, you know what? You could make a decision that had to do with relationships, your personal life, your emotions, and your heart. And I had no entrance strategy. I mean, I had no exit strategy. I had an entrance strategy. I didn't have an exit strategy. But when I came home, it has ended up being one of the best things I've ever done in my life. And I've expanded my heart. And I think life has so much deeper meaning now for me.
Oh, that's wonderful. Talk a little bit about your first arrival home. I mean, you did give up a lot. I recall reading in your book about that.
That was a bit shocking. We live in an 1865 farmhouse in Michigan in the country where I was born and raised. And I put all my stuff in storage, and I moved into this little tiny bedroom where all that's in there is some dolls and like a Three Little Pigs house. I mean, there's no evidence of the career woman I was or anything in my life, and except for my childhood. And I really felt very large in that little small room, and I felt like I couldn't fit. But I started simplifying my life. That's the other cool thing about putting all your possessions in storage. You know, what do you really need? A few pairs of pants, a couple dresses, my computer, and some musical instruments and some sheet music. Music is very important to all of us. That's one thing that I do with my father. My dad was a musician, and he's a great jazz singer, and he still sings with his 12-man a cappella singing group. And that was one of the first things I did when I came home. And life became very simple, and I also remembered that I'm not a bad cook. I can't clean very well, and my mother had to teach me a lot about that. After living alone, you know, my domestic skills were not exactly up to snuff, but I learned so much about that even, and there's something very satisfying at this point in one's life. I came home and would learn old family recipes. I'd go through photo albums with my mother, learn a lot about my grandparents on both sides, and I have become, because I'm a reporter, I think I remained a reporter when I came home, which was the result of that was this book, but also I recorded all the things in my family's life, and I'm the record keeper, it seems now. I'm putting photo albums together and learning so much about my family's history.
I think the estimates are that there's something like, actually more than 5 million people in this country who currently suffer from Alzheimer's, and that means that there are at least that many caregivers.
Yes, you know, when I came home and I started this blog on the WCBS website, and that really was the germ of this book, I had no idea. I got hundreds of responses to what I was doing, more than to any breaking news story I'd ever covered or anything I'd done in my life. I got more response to leaving my job to come home to take care of my father. And I learned then that there are 50 million caregivers across the United States. 10 million of us are taking care of someone with Alzheimer's or dementia. And the estimates are that 1 in 8 baby boomers will get Alzheimer's disease, and that by the year 2050, about 16 million people will have this disease. In fact, the Alzheimer's Association just a couple weeks ago said this is the 6th leading cause of death in the United States now. So Alzheimer's is considered an epidemic, and it's something as we all grow older and are able to live longer because we're in better physical shape, we are going to be having to face Alzheimer's in all our lives.
And you write about as well the caregivers can also become ill with stress and can really be ground into the ground, which was another reason I think why you went home to help your mother.
I did. I was worried about my father, but I was more worried about my mother, because what happens is this weird martyr syndrome kicks in, and caregivers just don't take care of themselves. They become so focused on the patient, the person with Alzheimer's. They stop going to the doctor sometimes. They stop doing what they need to do for themselves. I mean, my mother really sort of forgot what she even wanted to do with her own life anymore. I mean, she didn't even know. She was just involved in the caregiving of my father. So she was becoming exhausted, and she wouldn't even go to the doctor when she was sick. And I found that this was a common problem. Something like 62% of caregivers have a higher mortality rate than non-caregivers. So you're really putting yourself in a precarious position, and you have to take care of yourself. They report like 80% of them have high stress rates. They get ill more than non-caregivers because they just don't take care of themselves. So when I came home, I not only helped take care of my father, but I helped take care of my mother and helped her look out for herself and her own physical and mental condition. At least I hope I've helped.
Mary Ellen Geist is author of Measure of the Heart, A Father's Alzheimer's, A Daughter's Return. It's published by Springboard Press. You can join in with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, the number is 263-1890. You may have some experience of your own to share as well, and we'd appreciate those too. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Mary Ellen Geist, our guest, author of the book Measures of the Heart, A Father's Alzheimer's, A Daughter's Return. You learned a lot from the psychiatrist and from books that you read. And I thought before we take calls, food was an interesting issue, and the colors of food and how to help people with Alzheimer's in making choices and using even a fork or spoon or whether they have to.
Exactly. You know, I think that is one of the biggest problems is you want to maintain life normally. And, of course, you want to take Alzheimer's patients out into the world as much as they possibly can until it's impossible. We wanted to continue going out to dinner, doing things with my father, going to symphonies, taking him out to restaurants. But that's also very nerve-wracking. And I decided that when I came home, I could try to, my mother's a bit of a perfectionist, and as I said already, cleaner than I am, and more neat and tidy and organized. And I think it's very hard for a spouse to have to give up certain ways in which you're so proud of your loved one, your wife or your husband, and you want them to look nice and act nice and be like the person they were, but they're not really anymore. I mean, certain parts of Alzheimer's take parts of the person away. And you have to admit this sometimes. So in the house, I was sort of like, you know, can we throw normal out the window sometimes? So we would sit down. When I first came home, one of the most difficult portions of life with Dad was he refused to eat, and he'd put the food out, and he'd stare at it, and he'd say, it's too much. I can't eat that. And then he'd be like, Dad, please eat, please eat. I mean, you find yourself this whiny tone in your voice trying to get your loved one to eat, and that is one of the biggest problems. Well, I fortunately found this book called Learning to Speak Alzheimer's by Joanne Koenig-Cost. I highly recommend it. It's great. And she said, you know what happens? Sometimes your eyesight is affected. She finds this a common problem with lots of Alzheimer's patients. They look at the plate, and if it's all filled with a bunch of colors and a bunch of things going on, it's too chaotic. They can't figure out, is that a carrot? Is that a piece of meat? She actually talked about in a nursing home she went into, the people there said, well, no Alzheimer's patients, they don't like fish. They won't eat fish. Well, she found out they were serving it on a plate that was white, white fish on a white plate with white potatoes and something else white. They couldn't delineate. Their depth perception is often affected. So once they put something green like broccoli next to the white fish and then some red tomatoes, you could delineate. The other thing is utensils. It's too hard. My father calls utensils a handle. He goes, can I have a handle to work on this when he can't eat something with his hands? But you can just serve finger food as much as possible. Hot dogs, cut up in pieces, let them use their fingers. I mean, what is wrong with someone eating green beans with their hands? It's not all wrong. But it's sometimes hard to give up the daily living that makes you feel like life is more normal. But we all decided it was okay to do finger foods and have variety on the plate, but simplify everything. Don't have a plate piled with a bunch of stuff that's very difficult to discern.
I want to give our listeners a chance to join in, Mary Ellen. So let's go to Jackie in Crystal Lake, Illinois. Jackie, thanks for waiting. Hello.
Hello. I'm so excited. I love your program.
Thank you.
This issue is really very close to my heart. I just came back from Puerto Rico, and I'm trying to arrange for my mother to move in with my brother and myself. And I was wondering if you had any advice about the effect that this will have on your spouse. My mom is increasingly, she's a very difficult person, and she can really wear on you, and I'm getting worried that with her repetitive conversation that she really might be symptomatic of either dementia or early Alzheimer's. And do you have any advice at all for people that, you know, are in an otherwise strong marriage? I mean, both my brother and I are married, but it's really hard to give them what they need when you have another family depending on you.
So is she moving into the house with you and your husband?
Yes.
And your brother is not in the house with you?
My brother, no, he lives in San Francisco, so the way we have it planned is that she would be with him for part of the year because she does not like cold weather, and then she would be with me for part of the year. And we both have our houses. We're going to set it up that she'll have her own mini apartment, so she has her own private space.
That's great.
That's very important to her.
I think that's important. You know, I've talked to lots of people. Again, I'm not advising that all adult children go home to live with their parents and know that their parents come live with them. But what you're doing is very brave. But the other thing is, I think it's a really good plan that you get a break. That is the first thing I was thinking when you said that, because I think it takes a toll, especially on spouses of people with someone with Alzheimer's. You know, having the idea that you would have it half the year, you'd have your mother, and then half the year your brother would, you would have the shared concerns and the shared weight and the shared exhaustion of taking care of someone, but you would have a built-in break. I really like that, but I would encourage anybody. We took my father to adult daycare, and they're often really great programs that have music and activities and art, and you have to get away. Make it not all the weight of this should not be just you and your husband. Make sure there's someone else in the mix to help you get respite, get a break, and get away. And I think that would be really helpful. Also, you've gotten a diagnosis. You've got a good doctor, correct?
She's very secretive about certain things. And so when I get her here, luckily my sister-in-law is a doctor.
Great.
But when I get her here, I'm going to have her see someone and kind of in a underhanded kind of way have her tested.
You know, I think that's so great. That is so important to get a diagnosis right away. Often families are just in a state of denial, and we all cover up things really well because we don't want to face this. Just get a diagnosis as soon as possible and get going on drugs that can slow the progression of the disease. There is no cause. There is no cure of Alzheimer's, but there is a way to slow down this disease with the right drugs and the right kind of therapy. Talk therapy, physical therapy, even music therapy can make such a difference. And there are geriatric psychiatrists around there. I think that a lot of people don't realize that even through the County Agency on Aging, you can get certain doctors even free to take a look at your loved one. And they're actually free respite services. Sometimes you can get someone to come in your home 4 hours a day, twice a week. We pay $5 to someone through the County Agency on Aging to come in, and they can do showering and just spend time with them 4 hours so that we aren't the only ones taking care of them. So the Alzheimer's Association is a great one-stop shopping for all things Alzheimer's. It has a whole bunch of great resources and even someone to call. You will find, I think, when you bring your loved one home, that there'll be times that you're very frustrated, and there's a 24-hour helpline you can call with a counselor to talk about these issues, and they can connect you with services. I have some resources in the back of my book that I think are really, really helpful, but the Alzheimer's Association perhaps is the most helpful of all.
I remember my mother really, and my mother's passed on, by the way, but she really enjoyed adult daycare. It was wonderful for her, as you just described, Mary Ellen.
You know what? It was almost a sense of pride for my father. He was like, "Oh, are we going?" And it was his thing. It was his thing he did, and it was his cool. You know, I think he was very proud that he could go do that, and we needed the break from him. He needed interaction with other people, and he'd come home, I think, a little bit puffed up with pride after 4 hours of daycare and singing, and he felt a useful part. And he thought he was entertaining them, and he thought he was working there. And this was a really good thing for him, for his pride and confidence.
Good luck, Jackie. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Yeah. Good luck.
Let's go to Roger in Menominee next. Roger, hi to you.
Hello, how are you doing, Larry? I appreciate the opportunity to call you. My name is Roger Hansen. The reason I'm calling is the elderly abuse. It wasn't my father, but I was a welfare child of this gentleman. And this neighbor moved in, and she took care of power attorney. And she took all his money. And I ended up we're still in the court right now. A civil case, and I mentioned it to a lot of different lawyers, and they said, as far as undue influence, it's almost impossible to win the undue influence case, which I did win. I won the undue influence to show that she was unduly influenced, this elderly gentleman.
This is a big problem that you're raising, and I think this also is why I know not everyone can do what I did, and I'm not recommending that to everyone, but why loved ones and family members and children need to get involved, especially when there's dementia or Alzheimer's involved. As people get older, someone close to that person has to help watch over paperwork and things like that. And I think there are just a lot of elderly people that are just they're alone in their homes right now with no one helping them out, or they're in nursing homes and family members don't visit. So things like this can happen, and I just think it's so important to be surrounded by as much of family and community and friends as can possibly happen for people who are getting older and can be victims, such as this gentleman is talking about.
Yeah, thank you very much.
This gentleman, a week before he passed away, she had talked him into having a checking account earlier, and she went and moved all his money a week before he passed away. And when he went to the doctor said everything is shutting down. You know, and the doctor understood that she had hospice set up. There was no hospice set up.
That's just scary. This is why families have to get involved.
Thank you, Roger, for calling. Appreciate your call very much. If you'd like to join in with a question or comment or an experience to share, you're welcome at 1-800-642-1234 or in the Madison area at 263-1890. And you can email us at talk@wpr.org. And your father had a situation, not only was he dealing with the Alzheimer's, but his knees were shot. And
yep.
He needed
double whammy.
Knee replacements. And maybe you can talk a little bit about how that all turned out.
You know, I call that chapter Hospital Hell and Healing because it really was hell. I can't even tell you what going through a hospital experience with someone with Alzheimer's is like. And I know so many people in hospitals do their best and more than their best, and there are wonderful people working in hospitals, but I think the whole way a hospital is set up is completely wrong for someone with Alzheimer's. I mean, a person with Alzheimer's can't explain their pain. They can't explain what they need. They don't know what's going on or why people are poking them. Or, I mean, it was really a nightmare, and I didn't know how awful it would be until we went into the hospital. He's always been an athlete, and so the cartilage in his knees was pretty much non-existent, and he needed both knees replaced, and we just said, let's go for it, let's do it all at once. And actually, that event is what helped me choose to come home, because I knew that my mother could not handle that alone. This was a crisis. We had no idea how my mother would take care of him in the hospital or out during rehab. I mean, rehab with someone with Alzheimer's, you know, when you give instructions to someone with Alzheimer's, they can't raise their left hand or their left leg. I mean, This whole thing meant someone needed to be by his side, and that's one of the reasons I came home. I stayed by my father's side in the hospital pretty much the majority of the time. We had round-the-clock, all of us in our family, took turns being there. And if we had not been with him, next to him, I don't know what would have happened, because the hospitals don't have any specific plans for how you tell each person working on a person with Alzheimer's that he has Alzheimer's. So at one point, he needed an X-ray, and I said, well, I'll just go with him. We went downstairs. The person doing the X-ray didn't know he had Alzheimer's, nor that he had knee replacements. Said, can he stand up? And was going to stand the guy up right after he'd had, you know, both knees replaced. It would have ruined, you know, $70,000 worth of surgery. Nobody seems to be told from one person to the next that person has Alzheimer's disease. So, I mean, I wish you could tattoo it on their forehead. I have Alzheimer's. Or at least make it a rule that it has to be written on the chart that everyone sees. But unfortunately, all the people that work on a person with Alzheimer's, they don't always have access to the charts. So my father would be in bed, tubes and wires. He'd have to go to the bathroom or something. Of course, he didn't know that he'd had an operation. He leaped out of the bed. Alarms would go off. I mean, the whole thing was a complete nightmare. Very, very difficult. Anybody having someone, a loved one with Alzheimer's disease who has to go to the hospital, go with them. Make sure there's a patient advocate at all times.
Abraham and Appleton, we'll go to you next. Thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
That, you know, I just jumped in on the conversation kind of, in the last couple of minutes, so I didn't get your guesses, comments all along, but I am responding to one that it kind of affected me in a way. I wanted to express myself and get your opinion of feedback on this. You know, there's people like in different countries and different cultures, and if something like this happened, they would take care of the elderly people. Like, for example, you know, you take one mother, she might have five or six kids. She doesn't complain too much about those five or six kids. She can take care of those five or six kids. But when the mother gets older or the parents get older, now her five or six kids can't take care of her. And I'm wondering if a person is old and she's elderly and he's having trouble, and then they look around at his kids her kids that she took care of, and now they can't take care of her. But there's places like that in the Middle East and places in Africa where this is unthinkable.
You know, I think that's really interesting. When I was just telling you about the hospital experience, when my whole family was there at different times, and we were with Dad all the time, and a woman who worked in the hospital, who was Indian, came in and said, you're doing this the way we do it in my country. We would all be, we'd have food, we had picnics in his room, and she said, this is how we are with our older people, but she said, they're not that way with older people in the United States. And I think you've raised a really good issue, the caller did, because I think things are changing right now. I mean, I watched with interest the coverage of the convention last night. I'm curious about what's going to happen with healthcare, but there's also this resounding thought about the economy and how we're changing how we live. And I see a lot of, in the Detroit area, a lot of big empty homes. And I can't help wondering whether maybe instead of one family moving in there in the future, maybe two families are going to move in. Or someone's going to be moving in, their mother, their father, and maybe even that will help with the child care. And we're going to have, I think, maybe harken back to perhaps the 60s or even in the 1800s, the old farm families where you had an extended family and everybody was helping each other. Maybe that's what we have to do with the crisis we're in and return more to the way people do things in other countries. And instead of leaving elderly people alone in their big homes in the Midwest and throughout the country, or putting them in very expensive nursing homes, because that's almost impossible right now for a lot of people, which is why there are more people doing what I have done. I just found out, you know, I was telling you the stats, 50 million caregivers in the United States, 10 million of us taking care of people with Alzheimer's or dementia. Two-thirds of those people, though, are women. And I think that's very interesting that the voice of the caregiver is often a woman's voice.
Yeah. I want to go to Melanie in Milwaukee because I think she has something that kind of relates to that. Melanie, hi.
Hi. I'm 24, and I just wanted to talk about the really positive experience I had growing up in a three-generation home. When my grandmother came down with Alzheimer's dementia, she moved in with my father and my brother and I, and I felt it was such a blessing. I hear people talking about, well, we can't have mom in because of the kids, and really, you're depriving your children of meeting an amazing person in the family, and also just shaping me. The care and the compassion that I developed at a young age, caring for my grandmother and being cared for by my grandmother actually as well, just changed me. And I'm actually getting my graduate degree in nursing right now. So I just wanted to speak to that. And,
that's great. No, I want to share that with you, that I had no idea what would happen when I came home, but it has been a gift. I mean, I really do feel it's expanded my heart. I've learned that I'm patient after all. I've learned about a new kind of compassion. I'm not so wrapped up in my own needs, my own self, you know, my own identity as I had been as a career person. But I think you bring up a really great point, in that it is not always some sort of suffering to bring the elderly home into your house or your mother, your father, and that it can be a blessing and a gift, especially for the kids who are in the house.
Yeah, absolutely. Melanie,
totally. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for calling. Turk in Wisconsin, I believe in... Yes, Turk, go ahead.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I just want to tell you about my experience. I just moved back home, and I'm thinking that's what's happened to my dad. His long-term memories, things he did while growing up, he remembers like yesterday, but I could come home, and then he thinks I'm still on the road. And last week we did some work, and it's like he tells me about it like I was never even there. And I guess what I'm thinking is that what's going on with him?
You know, it sounds very much like it. I could never give you a diagnosis, but it sounds so much like what started happening with my dad with Alzheimer's. And I can't tell you what a difference it'll make if you can get him started on certain drugs right away. I talk about the drugs my father is on in my book, but the first call to make, I really think, is the Alzheimer's Association. But if you can get him to just your doctor, he can refer to someone that can give him a test to see whether he has Alzheimer's disease. And the sooner you can get someone on prescription pills of some sort or whatever pills your doctor prescribes, it can make such a difference. I think it's so hard. I know you're in a terrible phase of this right now because you don't want to find out, I'm sure. But if you can, the sooner you can find out whether he does have Alzheimer's, the better you all will be. You can slow the progression of the disease.
Well, now he's 86, and he takes, like, maybe about 12, 13 different medicines.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know, it's up to you, but I think it's good to find out.
Yeah. Good luck, Turk. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Grace in Manitowoc, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Grace.
Hi. My brother got some information, and this is perhaps people would want to check out a book called Alzheimer's Averted. And unfortunately, my scribbled notes, I can't read the authoress's name. At age 40, she was so bad off with Alzheimer's that she couldn't speak coherently, and she was having trouble walking. And she got help from the medical establishment, Oshkosh Hospital. And here is how to obtain the book or borrow it through interlibrary loan. You can contact the authoress at 920-734-9638.
She actually averted Alzheimer's. She stopped Alzheimer's
disease. She is working full-time now at the Science Gallery, Science and Hobby Shop on North Richmond Street in Appleton, Wisconsin.
I've never heard of this case. I'll certainly look into it. But, I mean, I feel like if she stopped Alzheimer's disease or averted it, we would all have heard about it because we'd all be racing to take that drug or do what she did. But I will definitely look into that. Thank you for alerting me of that.
Thank you very much for calling. And Phyllis in Milwaukee, hello to you.
Hello. I thank you for this conversation we're having. I am 82 years old, and I am alone. I am now very much, I have a blockage of the heart. I don't wish to have an operation because there's nowhere I can go. Nowhere.
Mm.
I'm in need for someone to come in, but they want $18 an hour.
I know. That's what we are facing, too. That's about the going rate to get someone to come in. But I'm so glad that you called, because I think so many people don't realize that if you could just go visit that elderly person that you know is alone on your block and just hold her hand or just talk to her, tell her a story for even, you know, 15 minutes. It makes a difference in so many people's lives. There are so many elderly that are just completely alone. And I'm so sorry that you feel you don't even want to invest in a kind of surgery to keep you living for longer. I mean, do you have any family or friends around you at all?
No.
There's none. I'm so sorry.
I've tried assisted living. They want over $1,000. And they take all your money.
Have you called your area agency on aging? Because there are so many county programs, and I'm not saying you might have tried them all and you don't like them, and I understand that. But there are often companions you can get for free or for just $5 to come into your house through the area agency on aging. And there are many resources, again, in the back of my book. There are elder care groups. But also, just if the community members and family members or friends can just get involved more in neighborhoods with people that you know are alone and just check up on them once a day, it can make such a huge difference in their lives.
It's very difficult for me to do anything anymore.
Well, I wish I could help you out.
So it's the, run that by Phyllis again, the agency, the area agent.
In Michigan, it's called the Area Agency on Aging. It's just there's a county agencies on aging, really, mm-hmm. throughout the United States.
Yes.
Every county has a group that is, it's a government group, and it's really for specifically, a woman like this, I think, would take advantage of this. It's through the government, and it's specifically, it's like the National Council on Aging is the Washington, D.C. federal government one. And then you have the Area Agency on Aging for your local area in the county. And you can call, you know what, I can actually give you the federal government number. And if this woman could call the National Council on Aging, you can go to www.ncoa.org, phone number 202-479-1200. Also, you've got the Alzheimer's Association, info@alz.org, 1-800-272-3900. That's not going to be for her. But here is the National Association of Area Agencies on Aging. And again, all these numbers are in my book, but it's 202-872-0888. National Association of Area Agencies on Aging will get her to the local county people that could send companions out to check on her, not only physically but mentally.
Well, Mary Ellen, our time is about up here. I want to thank you so much. What? So this has been turned out to be a wonderful experience for you.
It has, and I really didn't know that it would be. But I have found out so much about myself and about my family, and I know that I've made a difference in my parents' life. And also, I feel that my father, I had no idea what I was going to do with my life or how I would afford to be home. The advance on the book helped me to stay home and take care of my father for 2 years. And that was an amazing thing. And it's been a gift all the way around. I feel like my father reached through his Alzheimer's to give me the gift of this book. And I hope the book is a gift for other people. And if you want to reach me or more resources, I'm at maryellengeist.com.
Mary Ellen Geist, and G-E-I-S-T is how Geist is spelled.
Yes.
.com. Mary Ellen, thank you so much for being with us today. I hope your book goes really well.
Thank you, and thanks so much for giving me the opportunity to talk about this.
Mary Ellen Geist is the author of the book Measure of the Heart, A Father's Alzheimer's, A Daughter's Return. It's published by Springboard Press. And take a look at her website. I've been on her website. It's maryellengeist.com, maryellengeist.com, for some more about Mary Ellen and some more about the book. Appreciate having her with us very much. Well, Alzheimer's affects our brain, and I think physical fitness probably isn't going to necessarily help us with Alzheimer's, but physical fitness can help us in a lot of other ways. And Dustin Maher, our personal trainer, is going to be with us next to talk about how you and I can become more physically fit. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.